Sorry, Pete, I might have to restart my computer. It looks like my video won't turn on.
Oh, been like moving through treacle all day today. I'm actually amazingly feeling much more awake now than at any other point during the day.
Oh, well, that's good. Do you want to turn your vid on?
Oh, have I not? Okay. No. Obviously not that awake.
All right.
Hello, Christine.
Hey, Christine.
Hi.
How are you guys?
Good, yeah, real good. I just dashed back from the climbing wall. I had to take my son, and I think I left half my kneecap on the wall. But other than that, I'm all good. Yeah, okay. I'm just trying
other
to keep
people
up.
Will be climbing off it.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. It's like a 6B or something. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Backdrop Journal FFS podcast with me, Pete Coombs, and Andy Bill from the Backdrop Journal crew. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Peter.
You all good?
I'm good. Thanks, mate. Thank you.
Great. And we're joined today by Christine Falecki, who is the first and only female Association of Canadian Mountain Guides to have passed on a split board, which is quite some achievement. So hi there, Christine.
Hey, nice to meet you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no, we're glad you could make it. If you could just tell us a wee bit about, where you grew up and how you got into snowboarding and split boarding.
Yeah, for sure. So currently I live on the west coast of Vancouver Island in Ucuilute, and have spent a majority of my time kind of in what we call the Sea to Sky, so Whistler, Squamish area, which is also on the west coast of BC or British Columbia. But I actually grew up in Canmore, Alberta, which is in the Canadian Rockies, just outside of Banff, and spent my whole life in the mountains. So super fortunate for that. And I got into snowboarding, I think I was about 12 years old. Before that, my dad had me on skis when I was about 2 and just kind of sliding around, downhill skiing, cross-country skiing. I cross-country ski raced and then, started snowboarding. Actually, again, by my dad, he bought a snowboard and then bought my brother and I one to share. And both of us just kind of liked snowboarding more than skiing right away and got on that train. And I raced board across, not formally, for a little bit when I was a teenager, kind of when I was 16 to 18, just showed up for some races and went in with my girlfriends and we started winning and thought that was fun. So we kept doing that. And just kind of been snowboarding ever since. And then I hopped on a split board, I guess, must have been around 2009 is when I kind of got into split boarding. Before that, I was just fully being a snow bum, living in Whistler, working nights and riding all day for many, many years. And then, I read that Scott Newsom had passed his Association of Canadian Mountain Guides exam on a split board and was going to be guiding split boarding. And I just kind of switched gears and was like, that's what I want to do. And looked into how to go about that and just kind of switched over, got a split board, started touring more and just trying to gain experience and time in the backcountry.
And how did it go with sharing a board with your brother? Was there many fights about who got to ride it?
Well, I don't think we shared for very long because it was, I remember we had this like kind of looked like the ones that like maybe you like won out of a liquor store, like beer box or something, you know, like I think it was called a Frosty. Like it definitely wasn't the brand, but there was like this like melting snowman on it with a carrot nose and I don't really remember. Like, I just remember we probably both wrote it like once or twice, and then probably that season was like when it got put in our heads, and then the following year I know I got a snowboard. I don't know if my brother got one that year or not. And then, but yeah, both of us eventually both started snowboarding. My dad went back to skiing because he said it was too hard on his body to learn something at an older age. Right. Yeah, he was taking some hard falls.
It can be quite brutal when you first learn, when you're catching edges and stuff, you know, flipping over backwards. Yeah.
Yeah, nothing like a good scorpion.
And then, and what was your local hill then, if you were, you brought up in Canmore?
So it's just outside of Banff, Alberta, which is Banff National Park. And so we had quite a few around us. So probably spent most of my time at Sunshine Village, but also rode at Norquay, Lake Louise. We go down to Nikiska. At that time, Fortress was open. And then once in a while, we might go down to like Fernie or Golden or something like that as well.
Pretty good selection of places around.
Yeah, I kind of grew up in the good place to be a winter lover.
What's happened to Fortress actually? Because I went catboarding there because it shut for ages, didn't it? And then it reopened and they ran a sort of cat operation.
Yeah,
and I went catboarding there. It was brilliant.
Yeah, and I think they're still running as that, but I'm not 100% sure. I think there was like Pow something. Anyways, but yeah, they were a ski hill. They shut, then they started this catboarding operation. But I actually am not 100% sure if that's running or not right now.
They had some guy, because I was speaking to the owner when I was there, and they'd basically bought the resort, or I can't remember who they bought it from, but they got control of the resort, and they went up, and there was a guy that had been living in one of the sheds up there like the whole time it was shut. And it transpires that he was the old handyman of the resort, and he just didn't much fancy leaving, and he just stayed there. And I was like, oh, so what did you do? And he said, well, we gave him a job, but, you know, he knows more about the place than anyone else.
Totally. just sounds very much like Fortress.
Yeah, I had a real blast there. Yeah, I'd love to go back. I mean, they were planning to develop it, weren't they, and get the lifts up and running again, but maybe, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, that place has gone through many might haves, but
has it?
I don't know where it's at now.
Maybe they need to turn it into a ski touring splitboarding haven.
They've got good terrain for it.
Yeah,
like a bluebird thing. Maybe they should open it, splitboard 2 days, 3 days a week or whatever, and then run the cat the rest. I don't know. And then when you're in Whistler, just out of interest, you said you were working nights, but you're working in bars and things, or?
Yeah, I mean, I did a variety of jobs, as most people do in Whistler, but I started out, what was I doing? I worked in the winters, usually in the restaurants. So as a chef, or not a chef, because I'm not a chef, but as a cook, dishwasher, line cook. At one point I even became this like kind of manager of this little cafe of the kitchen side. Wow. And then I transitioned into serving but I never worked in the bars. I worked mostly just restaurants and tried to not take a breakfast job if I didn't have to. And then summers was kind of a mix of that, and sometimes I worked as a rafting photographer and just like whatever odd jobs you can when you're living that life of just trying to snowboard all the time. So
I did some chefing in the French Alps, and I'm definitely not a chef either, but I still cooked. I did all the veggie food. Like, once the chef found out I was vegetarian,
Like,
you could do all the food. Yeah, this was a long time ago.
Yeah, they had no clue back then. Yeah.
No, they didn't. No, it was like stuff a pepper with rice. That's all they did. Yeah. It's like, my God.
I spent a season washing dishes and doing the desserts. Split the job with the chef. I think I can still remember how to make the chocolate mousse.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I still had to do breakfasts, mind, but not every day. But, you know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you kind of figure out how to make it work. The place where I ended up managing the kitchen, I didn't last long because it was breakfast. Breakfast cooking gig, and I was like, yeah, I'm up here.
I'm a bit ill on a powder day. I just can't. Yeah. Yeah, I can't make it in this morning.
Just 5 centimeters. I gotta go.
That's cool. So I read somewhere online about that it took you 10 years when you decided to become a guide to actually becoming a guide. Is that true? Was that process that long?
For me, it was. It's definitely not the process for everyone. Because, I would have, when I first decided to start that path, so that was 2009 when I read that article. And then I saved up some money and decided to go to there's kind of two ways I saw of going about getting the guiding certs. And one would be to like continue doing what I was doing, but then trying to take time off in between and either hire a guide or and take some courses to get some of the certifications that you need, as well as just like some of the skills you need to learn, and then continue touring as much as I could just to get out. Or I could go and take this program at Thompson Rivers University, which is in Kamloops, British Columbia, and they have an adventure guide program, and it's a 2-year program. Well, it could be a 1 or 2 year program. And basically it kind of does what I was saying, but the advantage would be that you've blocked out that time so that you're not tempted to, you know, overwork and not take time off, which for me was kind of the route I chose. I was like, you know, if I don't actually like commit to this, then I'm going to work and always feel like I can't take the time off to make space for these things that I need to do. So I chose to take the TRU route and spent 2 years in Kamloops kind of doing their program, which is a mix of, you know, in school theory and that kind of thing. And then a bunch of practical education as well. So like a lot of time where you're actually going for a week long, like 8-day ski touring course or glacier course or mountaineering course. And it's not that you're certified when you come out of that, but it does help you get some of the certifications you need. So took my first professional level avalanche course through that program, took my first wilderness first aid course there, and then just also got introduced to a lot of the people in the industry, which was very helpful when I started coming out and wanted to get a job, and having some references of actual guides in the industry who had worked with me and could be like, yeah, you know, Christine is, you know, somewhat okay at what she does. It wasn't very skilled yet then, right? She's keen. So that was super helpful. And then that was been 2011, 2012 when I did that. And then I got the ACMG, so the mountain guiding in Canada, which is a little different than in Europe, is split into like different sections. So in Europe, if you want to be a guide, you go and you take the course and you're a full mountain guide, right? Like that is the guiding certificate, and there's no like just ski guide or just hiking guide. Where in Canada and other places in the world too, we split some our disciplines into hiking, skiing, rock climbing, alpine climbing. And if you have your apprentice rock guide, full ski guide, and full alpine guide, then you're considered a mountain guide. Yeah, and then you can cross over and get internationally certified and then also be able to guide in Europe. So for me, I couldn't come to Europe right now and guide because I'm not a full mountain guide, but I could guide in other places like New Zealand, for instance, who also does the system similar to us. And so as a ski guide and a hiking guide, I could go over there. And so the first certification I got in the ACMG was the hiking certification, which I got in between my first and second year of TRU. I took the course then, and then kind of use that as my summer job so that in the winters I could be a practicum and a snow slave and gain experience and go ski touring and all of that kind of stuff. And then I took my first attempt at an apprentice exam in 2016, I think that was. And so up until then, I was just kind of checking the boxes, like trying to create a resume and make sure that when I sent in my application, I would get accepted. And it's getting harder and harder to get accepted. There's a lot of awesome candidates out there and a lot of people that you're competing against to get into these spots. And so, yeah, you definitely want to feel on it and that you have the experience to back up your resume, because it will get recognized once you're on the course as well.
Yeah. That sounds like a great structure to help. Yeah. Help guide you through and give you a good kickstart into that, the guiding qualifications. I'm just wondering, did the this whole time that you were doing that, you had in your mind, of course, you wanted to do this on a split board. Were you getting any pushback from any quarters at that point?
Yeah, definitely. A lot. I mean, even when I first went into TRU, they did like a ski snowboard skills assessment to kind of see where you were to put you into the correct course, I guess. And even that day, they're like, you should really ski. And I was like, yeah, well, maybe I'll snowboard this assessment first and then we can decide, you know? Yeah. And
that's before you've even, before they've even seen you on the snowboard, you're just holding the board and that's bad enough.
Yeah, yeah. Right? They're like, you know, you should probably just ski for this. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, I can ski. I actually did grow up skiing. I have the advantage as one of those, you know, a person who is able to do both, but I just really love snowboarding. The turn is more fun. And so I definitely, you know, through multiple things, practicums, there was times when some of the people that wanted to bring you on to gain experience as a practicum wouldn't accept you as a snowboarder. And so in some of those situations, I did ski because I just felt like, okay, fine, like I'm not here to learn how to be a better snowboarder. I'm already a good enough snowboarder, I thought. So I wasn't worried about that. And I needed to learn these other skills, these other guiding skills. And especially when you're practicuming and kind of being in that snow slave position, you're hanging out at the back, your tail guide, you're picking up people. Yeah. It is easier on skis because you're not really riding the run often. So a couple of places I did ski for. But I definitely walked into places where a lot of times people were like, why don't you just ski for the exam and then snowboard after if you want to? And I was like, well, that's not the point. Like, the point is that I want to be able to know that I'm proficient on the tool of choice I want to be out there using. And there came a point where I was like, okay, I've learned, you know, the guiding. I mean, not to say that I learned it all, but I'd learned what I needed to know as far as it could go with me skiing. And then I just started not taking any more positions as a skier and only on my snowboard after a certain amount of time. And some places were accepting of that and were like, yeah, you know, we realize that you're qualified, you're good at what you do, and we don't actually care what you ride. And others were less understanding. And even after passing my first exam, my apprentice exam, still, you know, got inquiries if I could come guide for somebody. And then they'd be like, oh, but we want you to ski. And it's like, well, you're hiring a splitboard guide. Like, no. I literally passed on a splitboard. I'm not technically supposed to ski. Kind of interesting. But I'd say more and more, even every year, it's becoming more and more acceptable where I am. I think in Europe, it's still probably different. I think we just had the first snowboarder pass in the UK. I believe.
Well, I'm not sure. Okay. I'm not sure.
I'm just blanking on his name. He actually rides for Phantom Snowboards. Phantom Snowboard Industries there.
Okay, yeah, we'll look that up.
And he is, I'm pretty sure just passed his guide exam on a splitboard for the IFMGA.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, one of my questions was going to be the, if you did the course then on skis, but then it's fine afterwards to go on a snowboard, or if you did it on a snowboard, can you then, are you qualified to do it on skis afterwards? Is it, I mean, or does it not matter?
Well, it is this little bit of a weird, Yeah. So as a splitboarder who's passed on a splitboard,
yep.
I'm still classified as a ski guide.
Okay.
So when I say that I'm a ski guy, I'm not technically supposed to say I'm a splitboard guide, but I do, because I feel like, yep, it's misleading if I say I'm a ski guide and then show up on a snowboard.
Mm-hmm.
If I want to guide on skis, then I basically need to have somebody assess me and say that I'm qualified to guide on skis. And so I could work for a company and they could say, okay, can you ski as well? And I'd say, sure. And then they watch me ski and decide, like, yeah, for our company, you're certified to guide on both a splitboard and a snowboard, or sorry, skis and a snowboard.
Yep.
Is the idea there?
But not the other way around. So if you pass on skis, you don't have to be assessed to go on a snowboard.
It seems like people are just saying that as a skier, you're allowed to just go on and grab that splitboard and become a splitboard guide. And it's funny because I do have a lot of people being like, oh yeah, maybe I'll just do that. And I'm like, okay, sweet. When was the last time you snowboarded? Because it's actually like, it's harder to be a splitboard guide. Yeah, you got a lot more going on.
Would you say would be the pitfalls of being on a snowboard rather than on a pair of skis? I mean, presumably if you go all uphill and you're in snowboard mode, it's tricky. You've got to kind of,
exactly, right? I think it's classically what skiers always say about snowboarders in the backcountry, right? It's that we're not releasable. So recognizing that you are actually taking on a little bit more risk in avalanche terrain because you're not in a releasable system. And then also that if you are in downhill mode, so you're in snowboard mode and you need to go uphill, you're way less mobile. You can fairly quickly change over, but it's not as quick as just like, you know, either unclipping your heels or sidestepping up, right? And that's not to say that people aren't super efficient on snowboards, but you definitely are a little bit less efficient in some situations. And so it's a tool, mm-hmm, and it's knowing your limitations of your tool, thinking about those limitations and how you're going to deal with them if some sort of situation arises. You know, sometimes maybe you choose to actually split ski something because you're like, oh, in 100 meters I'm going to actually have to switch over to skis again, and it's just not worth it to to do that, you know. But again, it's a tool, and so as long as you learn your tool, I think you can be very efficient with it.
I guess you have to be a very proficient tail gunner to just make sure you don't go past anyone. So if any of the clients fall, you haven't got to go back uphill to get them, you know.
If you're past somebody and you're tail gunning, like,
it's a big no-no anyway.
Well, that happens to skiers all the time too. Like, it's just like it happens.
Yeah.
And definitely, you're just not gonna. Skis or snowboard is like, you're probably too far away from them to really be helpful at that point. So you're really just trying not to pass anybody either way you are. The reason I found it easier on skis actually to tail gun than on a snowboard is more just actually trying to pick people up out of the snow. Because, you know, sometimes you're like on your one board and people are in weird positions, and you're just a little more mobile on skis. But it's not to say that I also tail guided on a snowboard all the time. Like, you just have to figure out little different tricks and stuff like that. And to be fair, a lot of times, you know, some of these skiers are way bigger than me. It's not like I can just pick them out of the snow. So I had to come up with different ways to help people out of the snow than just pulling them up. So yeah, use what you got.
That sounds like a fun article writing about, or finding out all those different tricks you've got.
Yeah. Empower people to stand up for themselves, you know?
Yeah. Just talk them through it. And then, so you did the 2 years course, and then you tail gone for a while, and then you got yourself ready for your, what did you call it? Sorry, the assistant?
So in the guide system here, you run through an apprentice program.
Apprentice,
And so once you submit a resume, in any of the disciplines, you submit your resume. If you get accepted into the apprenticeship, then there's some sort of training period. So for the ski program, it's actually like basically a whole winter. So you go through three training courses over the course of a winter, and then you also get assessed on your ski ability, your companion rescue skills, and your crevasse and cliff rescue skills. And then you do these like a mechanized course, which would be heli skiing, cat skiing, a ski touring course, and just an alpine course, so more like glacier skills and kind of more mountain guiding skills, so a little bit of short roping and walking in crampons and that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, so if you do well on those, then you get recommended to the exam, which usually happens at the end of that season. COVID's kind of changed things a little. We're seeing a little bit of differences coming in, so that might not be the exact path anymore. But then, yeah, you'd take that exam and go from there. And once you've passed your apprentice, within 3 years of passing that apprentice exam, you need to take your full ski guide exam. So you could take it the following season, or you could wait the full 3 years. I, for myself, waited the full three years. I wasn't in a rush. There was lots for me to still learn. And I had failed my first apprentice exam and then got in a car accident. And then in the same year that I reattempted my second apprentice exam, which I passed, and I just felt like that following season was like, I was still in a bit of a recovery mode. And so, yeah, you know, I don't know. There's just
wanted to ride. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of it was like, I just didn't want to be in a training mode all the time. So enjoy some of this time as an apprentice when you actually get to work with other guides and it's not all on you yet.
Yeah.
But definitely some people go through way faster. I mean, I think technically the IFMGA, so the International Federation of Mountain Guides, ideally they say that's a five-year program and you'd be a full mountain guide in 5 years. And so our Canadian program is set up that you could become a full mountain guide in 5 years as well. But that's like bam, 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 you're doing all those courses super quickly. And yeah.
And
it doesn't always go that way.
Is it quite a financial commitment to
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not there's some financial aid you can apply for, some sponsorships and bursaries and scholarships and stuff like that out there for us. But it's not like going to university. There's no government assistance for you. And on top of that, like the courses and are expensive, but the gear itself is expensive. And when you're doing this, you're hard on that gear. It's, you know, not like you can ride the same. I mean, yeah, I can sometimes push my boards 2 years, but usually by the end of that second year, it's like, oh, hopefully this thing's gonna make it. You know, like ski clothes, Gore-Tex, stuff like that definitely can last.
Yeah.
But you got to take pretty good care of it, and eventually I rip it. I usually put something through it, and yeah, so definitely. And then all your, you know, ropes and stuff have a lifespan, your slings have a lifespan, your carabiners have a lifespan, harnesses have a lifespan. Like even if you're not using those hard, they aren't going to last 15 years, because after a certain amount of shelf life you should replace those for safety. So there's that. And then again, as you're like trying to become a guide, you're being a practicum, and that's an unpaid position. So for me, I was, my first few years there, like worked myself raw, basically just like volunteer ski patrolling so I could get a free ski pass, then served at night and then practicumed. And so I would go from like, you know, 2 weeks at a backcountry lodge, back come into serving at night at a restaurant, to getting up at 6 a.m. to make it to my volunteer ski patrol shift, to like just kind of this like no sleep cycling and not making too much money. So yeah, it's definitely not, I mean, I don't know that you can become a guide to be rich in money. It's more like rich in life money.
Well, it, I mean, it all sounds absolutely amazing. I mean, it does sound like you're living on tips, basically. You're just hoping to
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's becoming better as I've become qualified, more certified, yeah, and gaining more experience. I definitely am not as, I'm not as much of a ski bum as I once was, that's for sure. But
yeah, it has a shelf life, doesn't it? Being skint, yeah, just not, yeah, having any money. Yeah.
Your back, yeah, gets a little sore, and you appreciate a bed over a couch. And yeah.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, the next thing I wanted to ask about was just your take on the sort of guiding culture in the US, because my experience being a European is, and we've touched on this before in other pods, is there's much more of a sort of guide culture in the UK. People don't, or in Europe, people don't think twice about hiring a guide, other than, you know, the expense of it, if they want to do, you know, like a hut to hut trip, or even just a day tour. Whereas in the US, I could be wrong, but it feels, or US and North America, it feels a bit more like people go out and do it themselves. You know, they get a buddy and they go out and they sort of experience it, and they probably get it wrong and put themselves in danger. And, you know, but there does seem to be more of a sort of, yeah, you know, let's go, let's just do it, work it out on our feet. I wonder what your take was, of where you see yourself as a guide.
I think you've definitely nailed something there. Like, it, I would say there is more of an acceptance of hiring a guide in the UK. But it is changing here. And I maybe can't speak specifically to the States, but definitely seeing it in Canada. I mean, our culture started with having, you know, European mountain guides coming over here. And I think even kind of from our little zones, there's even a difference. So like, if you go to the Rockies, I think there is more of a culture of hiring a guide for certain things. But overall, I think, yes, I think here there is less buy into just hiring a guide. But where that's changing is now, I think, with education, especially in our ski industry, like ski snowboard industry, where avalanches are such a huge problem, you know, that people, even very experienced people, are getting caught, and we're having some very dangerous winters and those kind of things happening. And we're seeing more and more people coming to be guided, but we've had to have a bit of a different approach. And I think there's been some key players kind of in Canadian guiding that have maybe helped change that approach of more like an educational guiding versus like, hey, listen up and follow me. And so we're seeing more people coming, and maybe they'll take an introductory course of some sort with you, and then they go off and they do their own thing for a while. And then they kind of hit like a plateau, and they're like, you know, I want to get into this kind of terrain, but I'm not so sure. And then they come back and hire a guide again. And we're starting to see more like of a younger crowd taking up guides for those reasons. But yeah, I would agree that it's not quite the same as how it is for you guys in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, certainly for us, because, you know, we're living in southeast of England, near London or outside London, and, you know, we've got a fine timeline. You know, I've got two kids, you know, I've got commitments, yeah, here, and I can't just sort of go to the Alps for 6 months and, you know, wait for the best days and find the snow or study the snowpack as such. So in some ways, it's to get stuff done as well. Sure. We just hire a guide to, you know, to go over and get it. But
yeah,
what really pleases me with what you were just saying was the that you were getting young people that were coming in and sort of trying to be educated. So it's, you know, they're taking it upon themselves to try to get educated, or maybe their parents are forcing them to. I don't know.
Yeah, well, probably a bit of both. I mean, when we see our younger crowd too, I mean, maybe like even those more in their 30s and stuff like that, where before it would be those folks would still just like, oh, whatever, I'm just gonna go out there and do it on my own. We're seeing more of that. I mean, for a long time we've definitely had our international clientele who, yeah, basically see the advantage of hiring somebody local who knows the area and who's going to be able to show you the good spots, even if it hasn't snowed in a week or something like that. It's like, well, at least we can try to, they've been out, they're going to know where some good skiing is, hopefully, or at least something cool to go experience, versus hoping that your map reading skills and navigation are on point, right? And but yeah, I think there's a change happening for sure over here.
Yeah, I mean, on a personal note, I was out in the Alps. I was probably in my mid-20s, and we were just on solid boards. You know, there were no split boards really then, to be honest. And we were just riding whatever we saw, you know. And then one day there was just this massive avalanche that rolled down. I was above it, and it rolled down to where I'd been, you know, sort of an hour before. And it was like, shit, this is real. You know, I better do something about this. And I went out and got a transceiver and the shovel, and, you know, and then ever since then, it's been a very, very long journey, and slowly sort of trying to educate ourselves. And in fact, quite often, a few of the guys, Andy and myself in particular, will sort of early season, like December, just before Christmas, we might hire a guide and go over to Switzerland and stay in a hut for a couple of days and just get them to sort of run us through it, you know, refresh us on everything, and hopefully learn some more, you know. So
those things change, you know. We used to do shoveling differently than we do now, and technology changes with the transceivers regularly. Yep. Now it's like an iPhone and new features and new ways to search. And so I think there's a lot of value in refreshing those skills somewhat regularly, for sure.
Particularly we've been doing some trips quite far afield to sort of Kyrgyzstan and stuff, staying in yurts and you know, hiking up from the yurts and things. And we're really, really reliant on the people we're with, because quite often, even there where we've hired guides, they don't know their ass from their elbow. You know, they just they know their way, but you know, they haven't had a 10-year progression course. They're just sort of work in the local sports shop, I think, and know the way.
Or they know their stuff, but there's no way they're gonna share it with you. You know, it's just follow and we're going that way. That's fine. Well, I've certainly noticed that the North American guides that we've been with take more of an explanatory approach. You know, it doesn't take much for them to kind of open up and tell you a little bit more about why they're making some decisions, perhaps. Whereas European guides, in maybe just a little bit more about leading you.
Yeah,
it's a big generalization.
It's a difference in guide and culture, and we've had that for a long time here as well, where that was the normal, and there's just been a shift, and it's with some of the newer guides coming in, shifting how they guide, and it's kind of, you know, going into the rest of the guiding association, but also within our association itself, of just like trying to be more inclusive, more honest with our guests, and recognizing that we can all make mistakes. And so, you know, you might see something that I didn't, and it's good for me to know that. So.
Hear something, you might, you know, someone might hear some one thing or whatever that the guide hasn't. But I mean, so they don't train you then to light up a cigarette and just walk off, because we've had a few guides do that.
A couple of
Russian guides we had.
Yeah, the Cranabitters are no longer. I think that's out of the guide program these days.
Maybe they should bring it back. I don't know. And then nowadays, are you working independently, or do you work through an agency, or how do you source work these days?
At the moment, I am I'm a contracted guide for the most part, but I also am employed by some people, and it's been changing almost yearly for me of how I've done things. This year, I'm working a majority of my winter with Bella Coola Heli Sports, so kind of more northern BC, and then I will do a mix of ski touring and more kind of heli guiding as well out of the Whistler Squamish area with Altus Mountain Guides, and at the moment I'm not really doing, like, where people contact me, and it's not that I'm not, but I'm not advertising. I've kind of booked most of my work with these other companies at the moment. And some of that's just my own laziness. I like having someone else take care of the background stuff for me, and I can just show up and work. And some of it too is just like, With moving to the island recently, everything kind of has changed for me, and I'm just figuring it out this winter again and seeing how I'm going to work things. And so this is an easy way for me to kind of work out those kinks before I try to add more to my plate.
Well, that sort of scuppers my next question, because my next question was going to be, do you find that you're hired more by women than men?
I think there's definitely a growing demand for like women specific events, courses, that kind of thing. I do both. I definitely work with some organizations that definitely, like I work with She Jumps, and we'll be running some camps this winter at the end of the winter in March and April that are specifically for women. You know, I've been being the only ACMG splitboard, female splitboard guide in the area that I'm in. Definitely there's like a demand for me to run kind of splitboard women specific courses as well. So, you know, with various companies I've done that, but at the same time too, like I just go and guide as well, skiers, snowboarders, male, female, everyone is, yeah, all sorts out there. And I think there's value for both. There's value in being in an all-female environment. There's definitely women who feel way more comfortable learning in that environment, and just maybe pushing themselves in that environment, or they've, for whatever reason, they just prefer that setting. But I think there's also value in having a mixed group and having male, female together and having differing opinions and kind of learning how to, you know, deal with all of those things. Because when you go out with your friends in the backcountry, there's not somebody there who's kind of making all the decisions for you. And so working through those differences is a big part of backcountry skiing. It's not just about, will it slide? I mean, that's definitely a big part of it, but
yeah,
these interactions between us can play into those factors. So the avalanche factors.
Yeah, I think, do you think that women are a bit more risk adverse? I mean, I know it's a bit really generalizing, but it's just that another friend of ours, called a guy called Zach, he always says that you're much safer if you've got a woman in the group. Just because they might be a little, you know, a little less risk averse, or they might feel more comfortable about questioning stuff. Whereas men possibly, you know, would just think, oh, well, I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to look like I'm scared, or, you know.
Right. Yeah. So different human factors coming in there. But I think there's definitely studies saying that actually a mixed group has been proven to make the most, like the best decisions. Possibly women are more risk adverse, but I mean, I don't know if you guys have heard of Christina Lusty, but she's crushing it out there, and she's a skier, but her risk tolerance is well above most males that I know. And not saying that she is doing anything unsafe, she's just solid, like on it, and very skilled. And so I think it's just the way, differences in the way that people approach things. And so some of it might be that, if you're with all your buddies and you're male, maybe you're afraid to say anything because you don't want to be seen as the wuss in the group. Yeah, the chicken. And maybe the female in an all male group doesn't want to speak up because she doesn't want to hold the group back or hold the group up. So definitely possible, but also just differences in the way that people approach things. So for myself personally, when I'm like uncertain or feeling like there's risk out there, I'm like, okay, like, am I afraid just because this is fear and I don't understand something? Or am I afraid because there's actually something to be afraid of? Like, is there an actual factor here that I need to be afraid of? And I'll generally just start asking the people I'm with questions, so that we can start figuring some things out, you know? And so maybe that makes me more risk adverse or seem more cautious in ways, but it's just my way of trying to make a decision. It's like, okay, well, I don't know enough yet to say yes or no. So how am I going to get there? And, versus making the riskier decision and seeing if it goes or doesn't go is one way, another way of doing it. And I don't know if it's, I mean, there's definitely the studies out there that say that, say one thing or the other, but I don't know, you can make something say whatever you want, I think.
lies and damn statistics.
Is it maybe more and more that as guides almost have to start thinking like psychologists, trying to get
you just try to basically steer people into the decision you want them to make by presenting them with the information.
It's definitely their idea. I think that on a personal level, I think if I start to question where I am, there's probably a good reason for it. You know, if I start to just even just feel uncomfortable and I'm not sure why, like you say,
totally,
there's probably something to it, you know, and it's worth airing it. I mean, do you ever encounter, you know, if you've got like a set goal for the day and you're not able to, or you've decided that it's unsafe to do it, have you ever encountered, you know, problematic clients, let's put it that way?
I mean, I've definitely, that's like the always the kind of one of the, I mean, it's not the worst thing that can happen as a guide, but it's kind of high up there on the list of like, the worst things you have to do is say no to people on like the big objective kind of days, right? When it's like, okay, like you guys are literally paying me to keep you safe and that's what I'm doing, but I'm going to tell you something you don't want to hear right now. And so, you know, no one likes to have to be that person. And I mean, I've had some people who we've had to have discussions, you know, because they were unhappy, but I would say overall, it's always gone okay in the end. And mostly because it's like, well, these are the facts, you know, like we've got a warming slope and we need to go up it and it's late in the day and that sun's been on it for so long. And, you know, like we needed to be here 4 hours ago when it was still cold or something like that, you know, like it's like I know that you are a smart person, I know you have avalanche education, like without me being here, this is the facts, would you do that, you know, like on your own? So lots of times I feel like for me, I can use the facts in those situations to show why we're making these decisions. And things often are leading to those decisions well before you're at them, right? Like, so if I see early in the day that it's unlikely we're going to make it, I probably am going to, you know, drop some hints, make that a little known, like, hey guys, like this is what we're seeing, we're not ready to turn around yet, but we, you know, we'll continue on until we're sure that we're not going. And if we do, we have this other option, which is going to be sweet as well. So I think a big part of it is having another option or having multiple options. It's easier to make, like to say no to something when you still have other options versus when you've like only put all your eggs in one basket and then you're like, oh no, the day sucks and it's over and got to go home and did nothing. And
I remember, one time when I was doing a lot of my winter seasons in the summer months, I used to guide predominantly in Africa, and I spent a summer on Kilimanjaro, and we had one guy who he took a fall sort of on the final day. It's a really long day, you know, you get up at midnight and you start going for the summit, and he took a bit of a tumble, and I said, you know, as your guide, you've got to go down. I said, you can't go on. And he just point blank refused.
Right.
So I made sure that everybody heard, like the whole group heard what I said. And this guy, he got to the summit, but they literally had to get like a big flat wheelbarrow, wheelbarrow him off of the summit all the way down. And I must admit, I was a bit like, yeah, get in. I told you to go down. I knew I was right. I mean, he was okay. He didn't die or anything terrible. He didn't hurt himself. He just had some, you know, a bit of a bloody head.
But he put all those people in jeopardy who had to wheel him off the mountain. And, you know,
They were all the locals. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
you know, because there was no way we were helping because we could hardly breathe. You know, we were fighting all those inner demons and whatever, you know. Yeah, so I like the style though of, you know, drop a few hints and just, you know, so it doesn't come as a big shock.
Set the expectations.
I mean, I'm sure there's definitely probably going to be a time when I have somebody who is who might do that, who might refuse my decision. And I mean, ultimately it's like, well, you hired me as a guide, not to be your friend. So
yeah,
like, of course I want to get along with you, but in the end it's like, if safety is why I'm here, then this is the decision I'm making. And yeah, I mean,
yeah. I mean,
I don't know if I could drag somebody off the mountain, but
yeah, well, you're never going to get on with everyone. You know, you never like everyone you meet.
No.
Anyway, before we get in too much trouble, are you ride for Phantom? Do you use the Phantom kit when you're touring?
I do. Yeah.
When you're guiding. Yeah.
Yeah? Oh, yeah.
Would you say that hard boot is better for guiding than a soft boot?
I would say that hard booting is, again, it's a tool. And so like I rode for many years touring on my soft boot system, and I struggled on side hills while my ski friends just like, you know, marched along, and you're in this like weird skewed body position trying to hold it together on your one edge, and it's icy and you're like, oh god, I just went to boot crampons because I'm gonna eat it now, and
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And getting really tired and or split skied out of really heinous conditions for a really long time in soft boots, or had to, you know, spring missions where you're like on your skis, off your skis, on your skis, off your skis. And like I was often always with skiers when I was training for my guide stuff, because there just wasn't really a huge handful of us out there that were splitboard guide, like training to be guides. So I was always with skiers, and they were just so quick, right? Just to step in and then ski away, and you're like ratchet, ratchet, ratchet. Like, oh god, there's another 5 minutes over the course of a day. You know, that's half an hour that these guys have like beaten me. And so for me, also the boots at the time that I, you know, for splitboarding for females, I have small feet. I don't fit in the guys' boots. Like I'm a size 6.5 US. So that's what, 23.5, 24, something like that. And yeah, the boots sucked for splitboarding for me. And so I, for a long time I was like, no way am I going to ride ski boots. I'm a snowboarder. And then I made the switch and, you know, had some guidance from Joey Vosberg on how to chop up my boots and make them in more snowboardable. And it was actually pretty game changing right off the bat, just like efficiency wise for on the ski touring, like side hilling is no problem. Boot packing is so much better. And then my feet were way less tired at the end of the day. Just having like a nicer footbed kind of to push on, like my feet weren't doing as much work as they were in soft boots.
Mm.
And so that also related to like my legs being less tired, and then not having these like crazy body positions when you're doing split skiing or that kind of thing. So just not like tweaking your back or like just getting really uncomfortable. So all of that kind of stuff, definitely. And then, yeah, as a guide, it's quick, it's super light, it's very efficient for all things skiing, and you spend a lot of time in ski mode on a split board. And with the new boot, or especially the link lever that the Phantom bindings have put out, that go onto the Atomic boots, or if you buy the Phantom setup. So for me, like with a small foot, they don't make the boot in my size yet. So the option for others with small feet like me is to take the link lever and get the Atomic boot.
Mm-hmm.
And replace the walk mode with that link lever. And yeah, that thing is game changing for the downs. Like it is snowboarding again. It feels very much like snowboarding. And it's just like, yeah, I think like at the moment, I don't actually have a soft binding. I only have my AT set up, like my Alpine, mm-hmm, or my split set up, split mm-hmm tech set up. And that's partly because we moved and my bindings were so haggard that I was like, you know what, I'm just going to throw these out because I don't want to bring them with me. And, yeah. But even like last year when I had those, there was a few days where I had days off and I just wanted to go ride the hill. And my solid board setup was so janky and old that I just chose to ride my split setup on the ski hill.
Oh, really?
And nice. Had just as much fun. Like,
fantastic.
Yeah. So Yeah, and I think it's a great tool for guiding, but I think it's a great tool for anyone who just wants like efficiency in the mountains, really. But I mean, there's a lot of soft booters out there that are crushing it as well. So it's a tool for sure. And yeah.
I think a lot of it comes down to conditions as well, doesn't it? Because, you know, if you... I know, obviously, in BC, it's not always amazing, but you do get a lot of nice powder.
Totally.
You know, you could probably get away with soft boots a lot. But if you lived in Norway, you know, and you're side hilling, you're going to be side hilling on crust and crud a lot of the time. And
yeah.
And you really
We get a lot of Arctic outflows. So it's not like we don't see the crust. But I agree. Like, if I was just going to be riding like trees, some easy skinning, like, yeah, throw on my soft boots and go for it. But to be honest, I'm so used to that setup now, and it's so light, and it's so quick and efficient. Like, I don't even like touring in my soft boot setup anymore. Like, it's just the articulation in the feet, it doesn't feel as nice. Like, you don't get as good of a stride. It's harder on my body. And I mean, I have been riding on the Phantom setup for a while now, so I'm definitely quite used to it. I rode my Phantom setup on the ski hill because I thought it felt better than my solid last year. Right.
Must have been a wonky solid. Yeah. And what snowboard have you got?
I am sponsored by Palace Snowboards as well.
Oh, are
so,
you? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I ride mostly their Epiphany, which is kind of their all mountain board. I got on with Steph and Palace. When was that? Maybe 5 years ago or 6 years ago or something like that. I actually guided her at this women's she jumps event. So a women's mountaineering course, and she was on it. And then she came to me asking if I would, give one of her boards a try the next year. And I was like, kind of like, oh shit, a women's board, like in the past, I mean, at the time, any women's board I'd ridden before that, they sucked. They're like either noodly or just too small, or I mean, I'm not a tall person, but I'm average, you know, 5'6", and so I'm not super short either. So like, I just often found that I'd never ridden like Palace snowboards after trying several women's boards. That was the first snowboard that I'd hopped on as a women's board in like a long time. And I was like, actually blown away. I was like, this is an awesome board. And I've kind of ridden with them ever since. And they make amazing boards. And so I like their Epiphany, especially for the skinning too. It's got just like a nice shape for skinning. It breaks trail really well. They're super lightweight. And then for snowboarding, it's still got a bit of rocker, which I like. I don't want a full banana board in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. A little bit more directional again for the powder, and just like a nice big scoop nose up top, so you can get through the crud and through the powder and turn super quick in the trees and tight places. So yeah, I find that board to be a good all around, like I can hop on it in any condition and it's gonna ride super well.
It's great.
Maybe not good for the rails, but
yeah, we had Steph on one of the pods actually. She's lovely. She was great. Yeah. Great to talk to her.
Nice.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I guess you sort of inadvertently found yourself like as a bit of a trailblazer, kind of poster girl for split boarding almost. It's like there's a split, you know, any sort of female organization, they're like, can you come and work for us?
It wasn't my like intention at all. I wasn't thinking like when I decided to become a guide, like, oh, I could be the first one. It just kind of happened that way. And there are there are definitely other women out there that are guiding. You know, I'm not sure if like the certification levels that people are at, but I know in the States there's up and coming women, and in Canada as well, there's a lot of female split boarders tail guiding or have what we call the CSGA certification of at least a level one. So kind of a tail guide, maybe level two apprentice type certification, which is CSGA is a mechanized certifying body. So they can cat ski and heli ski. They're not necessarily technically supposed to be guiding touring at the moment. I think they're working towards trying to get that to come through. But the difference being is the ACMG is internationally recognized. So I can go internationally with my certification, where the CSGA is kind of a Canadian certification. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, it is kind of funny being, well, I mean, I even found it when I was training. I was like, okay, like I would love to go out with some other slipboarders who are guides, and there really wasn't many. And I got lucky. I got into contact with a couple of them. A lot of them live in Revelstoke, and yeah, so just had these guys that kind of took me in, and I learned a lot for slipboard guiding from them. But I tried to search out females, even just like kind of more advanced slipboarding female riders at the time that I was training, and there were none. And so, I mean, I think it's awesome that now women are coming up, and there's way more of them kind of coming out that are tail guiding and guiding it or working towards this stuff. Because I didn't get the chance to train with women. I mean, I trained with a lot of skiers that were women, but not in the splits. Yeah.
And then with this season, you say you're going to be up in Northern BC with, what was the cat, sort of the heli operation, was it?
It's called Bellicula Heli Sport.
Bellicula. And where are they based?
So they have several different lodges. But Bellicula, there's actually like a small, tiny community of Bellicula.
Okay.
So if you were heading, yeah, it's coastal as well. Like it's more on the coastal side of things, kind of towards like Terrace.
Yeah, we did a trip out of Terrace a few years ago.
Mm. Yeah.
Shame. So we know that sort of zone.
Yeah, you're going up into that direction. In that way, you're kind of still west of like Williams Lake and Prince George. Like you're not as high north as Prince George, even. You're just in line basically with like the tip of Haida Gwaii. So like the island of Haida Gwaii area.
I never heard of it, but no. I know Prince George. And then is your whole season going to be filled up with work, or do you have some time for yourself? Well, have you got any plans for your trips for yourself or anything
this year? Just with, you know, COVID being so unpredictable and moving, I said yes to a lot of work really early, and then realized more recently that I didn't leave myself a lot of free time. No. So I do have some space in there. I just haven't made any plans yet. I'm just going to see kind of when that gets closer, how I'm feeling, what's happening out there. But yeah, I think this winter is going to be kind of a head down winter of getting some work done and learning. I haven't worked for Bellicula before, so learning a whole new zone. And also with Altus Mountain Guides, who I'm working with, we're kind of starting a heli touring and heli skiing kind of more locally in the Sea to Sky area, and so like also learning a bunch of that kind of stuff as well. So so it'll just be a different winter for me, a little less ski touring than I have been doing in the last few years, and then my second season as a fully certified splitboard guide or ski guide. So still a lot of learning in that sense too to do.
Very cool.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't sound much like work to us. I know there's loads of work, but it sounds like sounds like a pretty plum job.
Yeah. And I mean, most of the time I can't complain. It's like from 9 to 5, I'm not really working, but from like 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. I'm working. And then from 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. I'm working with all the guides meetings and like all the other stuff that comes with
planning
it.
The day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds good. What? How is the COVID situation in Canada at the moment? Are the resorts opening up? Are the lifts all going to be going? And
yeah, I mean, as far as we've been told, and I think Whistler is opening on the 25th, so a couple days from now. Yeah, as far as I've heard, the plans are that we're opening different policies in different places. Some ski hills are mandating vaccines, others are not. But
restaurants. Oh, really? You're going to have like a COVID passport almost to get into some resorts.
Yeah, so in all of Canada right now, there's like essential services and so that are not, but if you wanted to like go to the gym or go to a restaurant, you have to be double vaccinated and you have to be able to have like a little proof of vaccination card that you have to show. And then so some ski resorts are saying the same, because like lots of places you have to like ride a gondola at the start to go up or something like that. And then others are saying just masks, but if you want to use their restaurants. So there's different policies, different places, it just kind of depends. But yeah, there's, you know, the recent is that COVID numbers have been a bit down, but they're predicting rises again, especially with
the winter
rising for you guys over there. And yeah, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, it's not actually rising in the UK. It's the same. It's just stable. Like there's a lot of it about. We've switched to herd immunity. We've basically just given up and said, you know, you can get jabbed, and if you don't get jabbed, that's your, you know, that's up to you. That's your risk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I mean, that's kind of where we are, except for you just can't participate in certain things if you don't have the jab here.
Yeah, the dirty unwashed come to stay somewhere else. It's a bit mad, isn't it? In Austria, they've gone pretty bonkers in Austria. They're compulsory vaccination now, they're saying. And they did have a lockdown for people who hadn't been vaccinated. They just said they weren't allowed out.
Right.
And then the ski lifts are actually closing. So they're planning not to open them. So
interesting.
So yeah, we're just sort of sitting here in the UK thinking, not again, because we didn't get anywhere last year at all. Nothing.
No, you guys had closures everywhere, and
we just couldn't get anywhere because you had to, you know, quarantine when you got there. So it was really difficult, and even getting to Scotland was hard, you know. So so we planned tons and tons for this winter, and they better come off, otherwise I don't know. We might be doing some stealth arrival by submarine or something. Right. You know, might start popping up in Canada by boat. Yeah, I don't know. Totally. Something.
Well, yeah, I mean, this year, like last year, heli skiing did not happen in Canada. Like that was all done. So, you know, with international travel being a little bit more feasible this year for people. Yeah. And yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's still the possibility that maybe that won't happen, but I think it's like way higher chance that things will be operating this year at a somewhat more normal level, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Right. Well, look, it's been lovely talking to you. It's
been definitely.
Nice to
meet you. And, you know, I hope you have a great season. It sounds like you're going to.
Yeah. No, looking forward to it. It's about to get started. I'm actually just packing to head out for some of my first guides trainings this year. So
that's exciting.
Yeah.
It is exciting, yeah. And somewhat sickening at the same time.
Don't worry. It's dry land.
Jealousy's a good look. Yeah.
We'll be in a classroom. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'll let you off. Yeah, 10th of Jan's my first trip. So I've got to wait a while. Yeah.
Oh, nice. That'll be good though. The snow will have arrived and
in fact, the Alps is getting dumped on. There's like a massive storm coming in, and the Alps is getting perfect. Getting really so it's, fingers crossed, it'll be a good year.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys, it was really nice to talk with you, and looking forward to listening through some of these podcasts that you guys have put out. I didn't actually hadn't heard of it
don't
before,
say that so, don't say that
well no it's exciting. I'm like, sweet, I'm about to go into driving season, right. And I got all this awesome content to listen to now.